Welcome to your June 2026 OHS briefing, a cross-country look at the trends, cases, and compliance signals Canadian employers should be paying attention to right now. If there's one word that captures the OHS climate heading into June, it's pressure. There is pressure from regulators, pressure from the courts, pressure from seasonal risk, pressure from labor shortages, mobile workforces, and more complex exposures. And there is growing pressure on employers to prove that their safety systems are not just written, but working. This month's developments across Canada make one thing very clear. We are moving deeper into an era where safety programs are being tested on whether they hold up in real conditions. Summer is arriving. Young workers are entering workplaces. Heat stress is moving from seasonal concern to legal and operational priority. And recent prosecutions and rulings are showing again and again that the biggest liabilities often come from familiar failures. Poor training, weak supervision, inconsistent enforcement, and controls that existed on paper but not in practice. Let's start with the biggest practical trend for June. Heat stress is no longer something safety managers can afford to treat as a midsummer reminder. It is becoming a front-burner OHS issue across Canada. The federal government has already adopted new thermal stress rules that will take effect next February, and Ontario is debating legislation that would require employers to implement more comprehensive heat and cold stress exposure plans. That means June is no longer early. June is preparation time. This is the point in the year when employers need to decide whether they are going to be proactive or reactive. Do they have weather monitoring triggers? Water, rest, and shade procedures, acclimatization rules, supervisor guidance, clear criteria for modifying work? Because once temperatures spike, that is not the moment to start building the system. And this matters because climate-related hazards are no longer theoretical or region-specific. British Columbia is investing in disaster resilience projects tied to extreme temperatures, floods, drought, earthquakes, and landslides. Newfoundland and Labrador's budget includes significant new money for emergency preparedness, wildland response equipment, and firefighter resources. Alberta is funding psychological health support for first responders. All of this points to the same broader story. Seasonal safety is becoming more operationally complex. Summer risk now includes heat, smoke, mental strain, emergency readiness, and resource pressure all at once. The second major June theme is young workers. The federal government has posted 100,000 Canada summer jobs positions, and provinces are also pushing student and youth employment programs. Manitoba alone is investing millions in green team placements that will create roughly 1,900 summer opportunities. That means thousands of inexperienced workers are entering Canadian workplaces right now, often in outdoor roles, customer-facing roles, or physically demanding seasonal work. For OHS leaders, this is always a vulnerable window. Young workers often want to impress, do not want to ask questions, and may not recognize when a task exceeds their training or authority. Employers know this, regulators know this, and after an incident, courts know it too. If orientation is rushed, if supervision is thin, or if the workplace assumes common sense will fill in the blanks, June can turn into a very expensive month by August. Another clear trend this month is that training portability and labor mobility are changing the conversation. Federal, provincial, and territorial labor ministers agreed to harmonize working at heights and mobile elevating work platforms training curricula by January 1st, with hoisting and trenching discussions to follow. On one level, this is about reducing duplication. On another, it reflects a national reality. Workers are moving between jurisdictions, employers are under pressure to hire faster, and governments are looking for ways to remove friction. Alberta, Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, and others are also advancing mutual recognition or labor mobility measures. But from an OHS standpoint, easier mobility does not reduce employer responsibility. If anything, it makes onboarding and verification more important. A worker arriving with outside credentials is not automatically job ready for your site, your hazards, your equipment, or your culture. Employers still have to verify competency in the real work environment. The next issue rising fast is privacy and surveillance. At the federal level, Ottawa has launched a review of the Privacy Act, and the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity has introduced a new initiative to help critical infrastructure organizations prepare for severe cyber incidents. Ontario has new digital security requirements for hospitals, schools, and other public sector entities that will require cyber programs, maturity assessments, designated contacts, and incident reporting starting July 1st. BC is debating rules around dash cameras in heavier commercial vehicles, while also emphasizing privacy protections. These developments matter because more employers are using technology to manage risk, monitor work, and protect assets. But the legal environment is making it clear that safety and surveillance cannot simply be conflated. If you are installing cameras, collecting more data, or adopting AI-assisted systems, you need governance, purpose limits, and documentation. Safety does not erase privacy obligations. Workplace violence and domestic violence are also becoming more central to OHS. Federally, Bill C-2025 on intimate partner violence continues to move through Parliament. In British Columbia, a coroner's panel reviewed 135 intimate partner violence deaths and recommended stronger training for law enforcement, first responders, emergency staff, and frontline service providers. Several jurisdictions are signaling more broadly that violence prevention cannot stop at traditional workplace assault scenarios. If violence reaches into the workplace through stalking, intimidation, coercive control, harassment, or threats connected to intimate relationships, employers are expected to have thought about that. The old model of a generic violence policy tucked away in a binder is no longer enough. The workplace has to know how to recognize risk, respond early, protect the target, and coordinate internally. Now let's talk about the cases, because the cases this month say a lot about what courts and regulators are focusing on. The most serious case is out of British Columbia, where an excavation contractor was fined $460,000 after being convicted of two counts of criminal negligence under Bill C-45 following a retaining wall collapse that killed one worker and seriously injured another. What makes this case so important is not just the size of the penalty, it is the legal frame. Criminal negligence cases are about more than non-compliance. They are about a marked and serious departure from the standard of reasonable care. In practical terms, this is a reminder that trenching and excavation remain one of the clearest pathways from OHS failure to criminal exposure. When hazards are well known, foreseeable, and potentially catastrophic, the system has to be rigorous. There is very little patience left for loose controls in high-risk work. Another major British Columbia enforcement case involved Tidewater Midstream and Infrastructure, which received an administrative monetary penalty of $182,282 after hot oil was released during an operation to clear a blocked heavy fuel oil line. WorkSafe BC cited failures including lack of safe work procedures, no hazard assessment, no hot work permit, no standby person, and inadequate PPE. This is one of those cases that reads like a stack of basic controls that should have existed before the work started. And that is exactly why it matters. Many serious incidents are not caused by unknown hazards. They are caused by known hazards that were not controlled with discipline. Hot work, line opening, energy isolation, and non-routine maintenance continue to be areas where shortcuts produce some of the most expensive consequences. Ontario delivered one of the most blunt lessons of the month. Integrity Tool and Mold was fined $185,000 after a worker entered the enclosure of a CNC machine and was killed because the machine was not powered down and locked out. Lockout failures remain one of the clearest signs of a weak safety system because they almost always involve a chain of preventable decisions. Someone assumed, someone bypassed, someone trusted a mode setting instead of isolation, someone entered before the hazard was neutralized. These are the kinds of cases that expose the difference between having a lockout program and having a lockout culture. Manitoba saw a $100,000 fine after a government wildfire worker died in an ATV rollover. The violations included failure to train, failure to ensure compliance with safe work procedures, and failure to ensure proper head protection. Again, this was not an obscure technical issue. It was powered mobile equipment, operator control, procedure compliance, and PPE. Across Canada, regulators continue to focus intensely on vehicle-related risk because vehicles remain one of the most persistent sources of fatal and serious injury, especially in outdoor, remote, utility, forestry, and response work. New Brunswick also delivered a critical lesson in emergency planning. New Brunswick Power was fined $75,000 and placed on probation after failing to prepare a written procedure for transporting injured employees from a worksite to the nearest healthcare facility. two workers fell roughly 15.8 meters during storm restoration work and one later died. This is a case safety leaders should pay close attention to because it shows how first aid compliance is not just about kits, attendance, or certification. It is about the whole response chain. In remote, utility, construction, and storm-related work, the question is not only can we treat the injury, it is can we get the worker to care quickly, predictably, and safely. There were also several cases this month about discipline, consistency, and how employers enforce their own policies. In Quebec, a ski lift operator was suspended and then fired after being seen looking at a tablet while operating the lift. The arbitrator upheld the suspension, but not the firing, finding that the employer's so-called zero-tolerance approach was undermined by the fact that other workers had only received warnings for similar misconduct. This is a very important safety law lesson. Employers absolutely need rules on distracting devices in safety-sensitive work, but those rules must be enforced fairly and consistently. If your paper policy says one thing and your actual practice says another, arbitrators will notice. Nova Scotia produced a similar kind of lesson. A forklift operator was fired for failing to report damage to a warehouse racking system. The arbitrator agreed that discipline was warranted but found termination too severe and ordered reinstatement without back pay or benefits. Once again, the issue was not whether the conduct was serious. It was whether the employee applied discipline proportionately and consistently. Safety policies are strongest when they are real, clear, and enforced in a way that workers understand will stand up if challenged. On the due diligence front, Quebec offered both sides of the argument. In one case, a bridge contractor successfully defended a fall protection charge because the court found the employer had done its homework. The rules were clear, the equipment was safe, the worker was experienced, and supervision was not shown to be inadequate. That is unusual, and the source material rightly notes that due diligence defenses that blame workers rarely succeed. But the case is still important because it shows what a credible defense looks like. It is not built on finger-pointing. It is built on structure, preparation, training, equipment, and evidence. In a second Quebec case, a company failed in its due diligence defense after an inspector found a panel saw without proper guarding. The employer said it had inherited the machine and that prior inspectors had not raised the issue. The court rejected that argument. In effect, the message was simple. You own the hazard now. Inherited equipment, infrequent use, or prior regulatory silence do not relieve an employer of its current obligations. This is an important reminder for acquisitions, legacy operations, and older facilities. If dangerous equipment is in your shop, it is your problem. There were also significant cases around infectious illness and accommodation. Federally, the Court of Appeal ruled in Chilewa versus Canada Attorney General that a personal objection to vaccination based on bodily autonomy and the uniqueness of human beings did not amount to a protected religious belief requiring accommodation. That distinction matters. Courts continue to draw a line between religion and strongly held personal belief. For employers, especially in health-sensitive settings, this reinforces the need to assess accommodation requests carefully and not assume every objection triggers the same legal analysis. British Columbia also saw a notable vaccine-related case in Northern Health Authority versus Duplessis, where the Court of Appeal upheld an arbitrator's conclusion that terminating a pediatrician's service contract over vaccine noncompliance was not justified on the basis of frustration of contract. The legal reasoning there is more specific, but together these cases show that infectious illness disputes remain highly fact-dependent. Employers should be cautious about overconfidence. Some mandates and responses will be upheld, others will not. The law still turns on context, evidence, contract language, and the specific rationale used. One more case worth flagging comes from Ontario on work refusals. In the Peel District School Board matter, the Labor Relations Board held that earlier refusals involving the same student could not be imported into the appeal because the board was limited to the issues and circumstances that were before the inspector at the time. This is a technical ruling, but an important one. It means employers need to treat every refusal investigation as if the record made in that moment may later define the entire dispute. Good documentation, good fact gathering, and disciplined handling at the first stage matter enormously. So what should OHS leaders take from all of this as we move through June? First, seasonal hazards are here: heat, smoke, student workers, mobile equipment, fatigue, and emergency response planning all need active attention now, not later. Second, enforcement continues to focus on the fundamentals: lockout, hot work, powered mobile equipment, fall protection, first aid transport, machine guarding, training, supervision. None of these are glamorous topics, but they remain where employers get hurt, workers get injured, and regulators win. Third, consistency matters more than many employers think. Courts and arbitrators are paying close attention not just to what policies say, but to whether they are enforced evenly and credibly. Fourth, privacy, cyber risk, and workplace monitoring are becoming part of mainstream OHS governance. The more safety programs rely on data, cameras, or digital systems, the more legal complexity they inherit. And finally, due diligence still lives or dies on evidence. Can you show what you expected, what you trained, what you supervised, what you checked, and what you corrected? If not, it becomes very hard to persuade a regulator or court that your safety system was more than paper. That is the June 2026 OHS picture across Canada. The temperature is rising, the workforce is shifting, and the law is continuing to move toward one clear expectation. If a hazard is foreseeable, your organization is expected to be ready for it.